Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop. The time is now 2:09 and 30 seconds. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on the Medical Monday to discuss oncology and cancer treatment is Dr. Christopher Dolinsky. He's a board-certified radiation oncologist for Northeastern Radiation Oncology in Schenectady. He has extensive experience with intensity modulated radiation therapy and image-guided radiation therapy, and has a special interest in treating lung cancer, prostate cancer, and breast cancer. Dr. Dolinsky attended medical school and completed his internship and residency at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. Dr. Dolinsky, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. The phones are already beginning to ring. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can just email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And if you want to see Dr. Dolinsky, all you have to do is go to wamc.org on your computer, and then just follow along. It'll tell you how to watch this thing live. In any case, we're delighted you're all here. I got one question, and then we'll get going because the phones are ringing. 1-800-348-2551. So, doctor, it always comes down to prostate cancer. People have a couple of choices on how they want to treat it once it's discovered, once it's diagnosed. Some people say surgery is the better way. Some people say what you do is the better way, which is, you know, radiation oncology. Which is the better way?
Excellent question, and I don't think there's actually one right answer to that question. I think there is a better way for a specific patient and a specific patient's problem. So the cure rate with surgery or with radiation for men with lower risk prostate cancers is very similar, but the process and the side effects, potential complications are different, not overlapping. So there are pros and cons of each approach depending on what type of process the patient wants to deal with and what side effects are more or less palatable.
So the side effects for surgery often mentioned, somebody becomes incontinent, or can't perform sexually. And what are the ones that are often related to radiation?
So we can do radiation for prostate cancer in one of two ways, either with external radiation or with a procedure called brachytherapy or a seed implant. That's a surgical procedure. And with external beam radiation, we don't really worry about incontinence. That's not something we see commonly. We worry about irritation of the bladder, irritation of the rectum. So with external beam radiation, we do worry about late-term effects in terms of the rectum, something called radiation proctitis, which could produce blood in the stool or changes in the way someone moves their bowels. There's a small chance of irritation of the bladder called radiation cystitis, which could affect the way someone urinates, produce blood in the urine, sometimes burning or frequency. With a seed implant, it's a little bit different. We worry about what's called a urethral stricture, the urethra being the tube that carries urine from the bladder out through the penis. We worry about the prostate swelling somewhat and causing a difficulty in allowing a man to pass urine, so someone going home with a Foley catheter or possibly having to self-catheterize. With both procedures, we worry about erectile dysfunction as well, although it's different than with surgery. With surgery, there is a concern that possibly the nerves get cut during the procedure, the nerves that you need in order to get an erection. No nerves are cut during radiation, but they are radiated, and that's something that could possibly affect a sexual function, although not immediately. It could be many months or even years.
And it is radiation, after all, and we know that there are some risks associated with radiation.
That's correct. People have studied this. This is one of the big areas of research in our discipline. And most of the studies out there conclude that if a man goes into radiation fully potent, he's unlikely to have a significant change. But if there's some underlying baseline erectile dysfunction, you worry more about the radiation-producing effects down the road.
Okay, I want to ask, and I want to get to the calls, but very quickly, we've now talked about men. Let's talk about women and breast cancer. What do you do there?
So it depends on the stage of the cancer. If you find a cancer very early, women has more options than if you find it when it's more advanced. So with mammography screening the way it is now, we often do find cancers early. We find them when they're stage 1, stage 2, sometimes even what's called stage 0, which is a type of breast cancer called DCIS, or ductal carcinoma in situ. For those women, they can either opt to proceed with a mastectomy or a lumpectomy, which is just removal of the tumor. And if they have a lumpectomy, then they do require radiation therapy. So the majority of the patients I treat for breast cancer are having the more limited surgeries followed by radiation to the breast. And it's been well documented that that procedure, the lumpectomy plus radiation, is just as effective as a mastectomy. Women with more advanced cancers might have to undergo a mastectomy and then possibly receive radiation afterwards in order to decrease the risk of it returning. But depending on the stage, things can get sequenced differently.
Okay, let's go to Bob in Saratoga. Right, Bob, you're on.
Yes, I was just curious, how often does the benign prostate enlargement become prostate cancer? And I am taking currently two different drugs for the prostate. And just trying to figure out whether I'm overdoing it, or is there some vitamins? I know that salt, pimento, and et cetera is recommended.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of your question.
It was my fault. I have to say, Bob, I was distracted. I'm trying to get his headphones on correctly. Go ahead. I'm sorry. So can you repeat the first part of your question?
Yes. I have benign prostate enlargement, taking currently two medications, although I'm going to be switching just to one, with just more of the one. And was wondering whether I should be taking also supplemento, and other things they recommend, vitamin supplements. As I told my sons, that they should be taking care of their prostate before they get older.
So the best medicines out there for benign prostatic hypertrophy are prescription medicines that you would get from your urologist or your primary physician.
Right. I'm getting generics, but yes.
Yes. Various herbs or supplements have been touted to have benefits and haven't been studied with the same sort of
FDA rigor
as prescription medications. I don't think that medications like salt palmetto or some of the vitamins you might see at GNC are going to help a whole lot, although I don't think they'd hurt either. So I don't routinely recommend that people take things like that. But if they're interested in them, I don't try and dissuade them. I don't think they're harmful. I just don't think they're very helpful.
So what are you on, Bob? Finasteride?
Temulucin, Tarotsin, Simvastatin. Well, Simvastatin, I guess, is the, for the statin.
Yeah. Okay, hey, Bob, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Okay, Jim, you're on.
How effective is radiation therapy for fibrosarcoma?
So that's an interesting question. Fibrosarcoma is traditionally considered a cancer that is not very responsive to radiation therapy. So that's the teaching. Fibrosarcoma is a cancer that if you radiate is unlikely to get a whole lot smaller. Now, that doesn't mean that radiation isn't effective. One of my mentors in training would tell a story about a patient with fibrosarcoma that couldn't receive surgery based on the location of the cancer that had radiation, had a complete response to treatment. So it's not that it's impossible, it's just that it's less likely to cause the tumor to shrink a whole lot. And with a cancer like that, oftentimes the goals of our treatment are to get it to stop growing, which radiation can be very effective at doing, even though it doesn't shrink or disappear.
Jim, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Very good answer. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in are excellent. We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Barry Price Architecture. Since 1996, specializing in buildings that integrate modernism and sustainability with regional materials and aesthetics. BarryPriceArchitecture.com. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. ChooseSTMarys.com. And the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com.
So here we are back on the Vox Pop with Dr. Christopher Dolinsky of Northeastern Radiation Oncology in Schenectady, New York. I guess the one place we've gone to prostate, we've gone to breast, let's go to lung for a minute. What do you do with lungs?
Excellent question. So this is something that's rapidly evolving. Lung cancer is a very difficult cancer to control, particularly when you find it at a later stage. Yeah. And right now, most patients that are diagnosed with lung cancer are diagnosed when it is at a later stage.
Or otherwise known as too late.
That's one way to put it, yes. The cure rate for a stage 3 lung cancer might be 15 to 20%, while the cure rate for a stage 1 lung cancer might be 85%.
Wow.
And for a long time, doctors have been trying to figure out the best way to find patients when their cancers are early. They studied chest x-rays and weren't able to demonstrate any improvement in a patient in a population that was screened with a chest x-ray compared to not. But an important study that was published a few years back in the New England Journal demonstrated that the use of low-dose CAT scans can improve the chances that you detect a cancer early and actually that the screened population will be cured, increase the odds that those patients will be alive. So the United States Preventive Task Force recently issued a recommendation that all patients who are smokers begin getting screened with these low-dose CT scans. They define smokers as someone who has smoked for 30 pack years. That's the way we describe it in oncology.
What does that mean?
So if you smoke a pack a day for 30 years, that would be 30 pack years. Or if you smoked 2 packs a day for 15 years, that would be 30 pack years.
Hmm.
So if you smoked at least 30 pack years, you're between the ages of 55 and 80, and you're continuing to smoke or stop smoking within 15 years, the recommendation is now an annual low-dose screening CAT scan. So at Ellis Hospital, we have begun working on getting a lung cancer screening program going. And this is going to be a very, very important thing for the patients in our community to utilize. Primary physicians, just as they traditionally have been told, women need their mammograms on an annual basis, and people need their colonoscopies once they turn 50, are going to be sending their smoking patients for these CAT scans. We have a multidisciplinary team, radiologists, oncologists, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, thoracic surgeons, pulmonologists, and pathologists, as well as dedicated nurse navigators to help patients move through this system.
What's a nurse navigator?
So this is a complicated thing to do. Someone says, all right, I want you to go over and have a CAT scan done. Someone needs to follow up on that result, contact the patient if further testing needs to be done or possibly a biopsy, make appropriate referrals to the physicians that can accommodate that, and then communicate back with the primary physician that made the referral initially. So a nurse navigator, a model that we've utilized in breast cancer screening, is going to be used here as well.
Okay, we're going to John in Catskill. John in Catskill, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, John.
All right. A year ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. They did a biopsy, Gleason 6.
Mm-hmm.
The only time that I had a PSA of over 2 was at that time. Since then, my PSA is 2.1, 1.9. And last week, 2.8. My question, though, is a lot of people are telling me I should have never had the biopsy because now I opened up a can of worms, the cancer could spread. Is that true?
So that's a very common misconception. Doing a biopsy cannot spread your cancer. But it brings up an interesting part of your question. Should you have had the biopsy or not? Do you mind if I just ask a question to you? Was it the PSA that prompted the biopsy, or did someone feel something abnormal on a rectal examination?
Well, through a rectal examination, the first doctor said, okay, I believe you have cancer, and we're going to do a biopsy. Mm-hmm. I had four doctors after that that examined me and said, if you ever came to me first, I would have never done the biopsy. Mm-hmm. It's so darn small.
Mm-hmm. So whenever we find prostate cancer, our first job is to get a sense of how bad it is, how aggressive it is, because some prostate cancers grow very, very, very slowly. We call those low-risk cancers. Those are the cancers that, if left alone, if you were to do absolutely nothing with, would be unlikely to cause a man problems in 10, 15, sometimes even 20 years. So one of the controversies about PSA screening involves the fact that many of the cancers we diagnose in older men are this low-risk variety and never really need to be treated. Without knowing the specifics of your case, that may be what you're dealing with. And so nowadays, one of the recommendations for patients with low-risk cancer is to consider not having it treated at all, but just observed.
Right, well, that's what I'm going through right now. With I went finally to Mount Sinai,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Daly there has been putting me, just watching. We're watching me, my PSA.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 68. When I first got diagnosed, I was a Gleason 6.
Hold on a second. Gleason, just for our listeners, is?
So that's the numerical score that the pathologist gives the specimen when he looks, or he or she looks at it under the microscope to tell us how aggressive it looks.
Yeah, is 6 high?
6 would be considered low risk. So
what's high?
So 8, 9, and 10 are considered high risk. 7s are considered intermediate, and Gleason 6s or below are considered low risk.
I see. Okay, so John, what are you going to do about it?
The last thing I found out, I looked online, is I found that the claims are in Germany they have a non-invasive procedure that seems to be almost 100% successful over the past 25 years.
So right now in the United States, the traditional methods that we talk about for treatment of prostate cancer involve radical prostatectomy, the surgery, external radiation, or a seed implant, or active surveillance. There are some other technologies out there. There's a way to freeze it called cryotherapy. There's high-frequency ultrasound, or HIFU, that have been studied, but not as extensively as the treatments I just mentioned. I don't know what the future is going to hold, but usually in the United States, a man with prostate cancer who's going to opt for some sort of treatment heads towards surgery or radiation therapy.
I'm sorry.
With a low-risk case, there's a decent chance that you're not going to have to do anything about it. We're more comfortable observing men if they're older or if they have other medical problems. And doctors are notoriously bad at predicting how long people are going to live. But if a man comes in and he's 95 in a wheelchair with that diagnosis, no one's going to ever say you need to have this treated. But if a man came in at 48 in excellent health with a low-risk cancer, I think he's going to be recommended to have some sort of treatment.
Don't you think 68 is the new 48?
Obviously.
At least I do. Okay, John, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. Okay, we'll go to Rob in Great Barrington, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in are better than excellent. Okay, go ahead, Rob.
Hi, I forgive my ignorance on this. I'm wondering, what is the difference between radiation used to treat cancer in your practice and radiation that may be the cause of cancer from devices like Wi-Fi or cell phones, or even fallout from something like Fukushima?
That's an excellent question. So I'm going to start with the comment about cell phones. I'm not sure the jury is out whether or not cell phones cause cancer, but people are looking into that. But essentially, your question is, why would we recommend something that could cause cancer with
right.
radiation therapy, and how is that different?
Right.
The most radiation exposure that your average person around gets is from the sun or from background natural sources of radiation. The second most common source of radiation exposure is through medical imaging. Any radiation that you receive could possibly cause a cancer. The odds of that go up as you receive more radiation dose. It's called a stochastic thing. But it's still very, very, very rare. It's not something that happens commonly. When we're using radiation for therapeutic purposes because someone has a malignancy, we make the we come to the conclusion that the benefits outweigh the risks. The benefits of possibly curing the cancer or slowing it down outweigh the small but real risk that the cancer could be caused by the radiation.
But wouldn't the answer to that be I'll opt for the surgery as opposed to the radiation?
Possibly. But radiation, if it causes cancers, usually many, many years after the exposure. I'm talking 15, 20, 30.
Interesting.
And it's still a very, very unusual thing. So it's kind of like saying, yeah, all right, Powerball's out. I'm going to buy myself a ticket to Powerball. And then I say, well, I can double my chances if I buy two tickets.
Sure, it's
I'm still not going to win Powerball, even though I just doubled the likelihood of it.
Hey, somebody's got to win.
That's true. But if you have a radiation exposure, which slightly increases your risk of something that's pretty uncommon, we don't worry about it so much. Yeah. Now, that only applies to adults and older folks. We are very, very nervous and careful about delivering any ionizing radiation to children or adolescents.
Okay, but I want to just we have all five phones ringing, so I want to make it fast here. But Rob raised an interesting question about Fukushima. I'm getting a lot of these sort of, you know, calls about Fukushima. Do we have any evidence that the Fukushima release is affecting people in this country?
I do not think there's any evidence of that in this country. I think there will likely be some evidence of effects on the Japanese population in a few years. A lot of what we know about radiation's effect on populations come from radiation disasters, from Chernobyl, from the atomic bomb in Japan. And so people that were in the fallout region and received much more radiation than everyone else had or has at this point. And so the increased incidence of cancers we found have helped us model this and get a sense of how radiation affects likelihood of developing a malignancy.
Rob, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Nikki in Saratoga Springs. Nikki, you're on.
Yes, doctor. I have a question about getting the radiation treatments and the scar tissue, you know, that you get afterwards. The radiation was done in 2012, and you know, the scar tissue, does it keep growing and growing, or is there a point when it will stop?
So, excellent question, Nikki. So, one of the things about radiation that I think a lot of people don't understand, including medical professionals, is that many of the effects of radiation don't manifest for a very long time after someone is radiated. So we worry about what we term late effects, which could be many years. Usually radiation during its delivery causes local effects that get better shortly after it's done, within a few weeks.
Okay.
But it can start to actually change tissues over time, many, many months or even years later. Some areas of the body are more prone to developing what we call fibrosis or scar tissue than others. And in some cases, it's just the genetics of the patient. That for whatever reason, they're more predisposed to having radiation affect their tissues in that way.
Now, to jump on to Nikki's good question, we're hearing more and more about something called adhesions. Do we have any idea whether radiation and adhesions have anything to do with each other?
I don't think that they do. I think that adhesions, or at least the way I think about them, are related to surgery. With radiation, its late effect changes of tissues caused by the radiation, and I wouldn't really put them in the same category.
Nikki, see what you started? Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. Let's go to, what's that? Is the next one three? Okay. Gregory in Kingston. Okay, Gregory, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'd just like to hear, I'm a 56-year-old healthy man, and I'd like to hear a little bit about preventive measures on the prostate. I understand you said that to the other person who's already has the problem that that the salt palmetto and pumpkin seeds and whatnot are not something that you think does very much. But as a preventive medicine, I'd like to know about that.
So, excellent question, and I think a lot of people would like to know about this. Unfortunately, I don't have a really good answer for you. There's not a lot out there that is, in my mind, been conclusive about good chemo prevention of prostate cancer.
So if the FDA hasn't studied it, it's hard to give a good answer.
People have studied things, but yeah. Nothing has been a slam dunk. PSA, as you probably know, is a controversial thing.
Yep,
some
sure.
people think it should be done. Other people don't. I think that it needs to be individualized, that all screening as a tool should be individualized to a patient in terms of their risk of developing a disease. If someone has a strong family history of prostate cancer, then I would recommend PSA screening and
okay.
a rectal exam.
But I think what Gregory wants to know is, are there any generally accepted ways of avoiding prostate cancer? Right, Gregory?
Yes, nutritionally or yeah. Supplementally.
My answer, unfortunately, is no. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that I'm aware of that has been conclusively demonstrated to decrease the risk of a man's developing prostate cancer.
And but of course, there are always people. I was just talking about this morning with another doctor in alternative medicine. There are always people who will push the stuff despite the fact that there aren't studies. Quite often, it'll be people. I don't want to name a particular subspecialty who are not allowed to prescribe. So if they're not allowed to prescribe regular medicines, they'll prescribe other medicines. Gregory, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Jules in Hillsdale. Okay, Jules in Hillsdale, you're on.
Hello. Yes, hello, Alan and the doctor.
Hello, Jules.
In 1997, I had a retinal melanoma in my left eye, which was successfully treated with proton beam therapy at the Mass General Eye and Ear Infirmary. I'm curious, has proton beam therapy, radiation therapy, ever been used on prostate cancer? And what other kinds of tumors these days is it used on?
That's a really, really excellent question. So proton beam radiation is all the rage in my specialty. For a long time, there are only two institutions in America that did proton beam radiation, Loma Linda in California and Mass General. So they have the most experience. But proton centers have been going up right and left. The way that protons interact with matter is different than the way that X-rays interact with matter. The energy deposited from protons comes in and stops. There's no exit dose like there is with photons, with X-ray radiation like I use in my department.
What does that mean, exit?
So if I point a radiation beam at someone's tumor, it's going to deliver radiation dose on its way in and on its way out.
How does it get out?
It just keeps going. There's some dose that is delivered even after it hits the tumor.
Okay.
So you often have to come in from a lot of different angles so that you can make the radiation dose cloud inside the patient high and spread low dose around.
Okay, I'm sorry for interrupting. So go ahead in terms of the proton.
So protons go in and stop, which means you might be able to treat someone from one angle or two angles.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes in and stops so that you can treat a tumor that's really, really close to something that you don't want to get any other radiation. So if the tumor is next to a critical structure that can't get over-radiated, then protons might be the solution to that problem.
So do you do this now?
I do not do this. This is not done locally. This is essentially a type of radiation that you would get in a big academic center. More of them are being built around the United States. They were traditionally used for pediatric malignancies. With kids, you don't want to spread a lot of even low-dose radiation around because their tissues are growing. It's traditionally used for certain tumors that are against the spinal cord or tumors of the spinal cord.
Interesting.
Tumors that are really close to structures that can't get over radiated. And then people said, well, what about prostate cancer? It's right next to the rectum and it's right next to the bladder. And so nowadays, that's actually the disease that is most commonly treated with protons.
Really?
There's not enough data to suggest that it's any better than what we can do with typical old photons with intensity modulated radiation, the type of radiation that most men with prostate cancer would receive. And I'm not sure it's ever going to be conclusively demonstrated that there is an improvement, but it's something that people are looking at right now.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, but before we do, I just want to give the phone number and tell you your chances now are 100% of getting in. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, April 12, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu. Premier Medical Group, Gastroenterology, Urology, Internal Medicine, Endocrinology, Geriatrics, Nephrology, and Pulmonology, with offices throughout the Hudson Valley, premiermedicalhv.com. Marriott Town Place Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio, one- and two-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. TPSAlbany.com for reservations. And The Blue Marble, a world of gifts, Amherst, Massachusetts, featuring goods from across the country and around the globe with a concentration on handcrafted, American-made, and fair trade items. TheBlueMarble.biz.
And we are back, and the phones are ringing like crazy. So just to reprise, we discussed a couple of things. One is your services are used on the prostate, they are used in breast cancer, and they are used on the lung, among other places. Anything else that we're not talking about?
Every possible cancer from head to toe.
Right.
So those are the common malignancies that we treat. Speaking
of which, have you ever treated cancer of the toe?
The skin of the toe, absolutely.
I see.
So we treat skin cancers, which can obviously be anywhere.
Right.
Brain tumors, cancers of the head and neck, lips, tongue, larynx, esophagus, pancreas, stomach.
Okay, let's go to Portia in Leverett, Massachusetts. Okay, Portia, you're on.
Hi, I'm a little embarrassed to ask this, but I'm 71 right now, and when I was born, before I was a year old, I have learned from my parents' journals that I leapt out of my crib in some sort of bizarre eagerness to be alive and broke my collarbone and got two x-rays back in 1942. And it's always occurred to me that way back then they must have been much less cautious about x-rays. And I was just wondering what your response to that is. It's something about, periodically, I just wonder about this, and I'm so glad to be able to ask you.
So, a great question. People were very cavalier with radiation back in the day. You used to be able to go to a shoe store and stick your foot.
I remember.
Yep.
That's not good. We don't do that anymore.
I know.
And because people have started to realize that radiation exposure is not a good thing unless you need it.
I heard a story the other day about a psychiatrist back in the day who used to cure psychiatric problems with doses of radiation. So
that's fascinating. I'd like to read about that.
Right. Interesting thing. So you got your answer, Porsche?
I don't know. I mean, you said it was cavalier.
Yeah.
But I haven't died.
So
not yet.
The chances that you would have something bad happen to you from that x-ray or two are very, very slim.
Then when it was very cavalier?
Yeah. If you had had an x-ray a week, for 3 years, then I'd be a lot more worried about it.
Okay. Well, I'm actually not worried. I've just been curious about it. And so thank you so much for asking a 40-year-old question I've had.
There
no
you
problem.
Go. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Let's go to Peter in Albany. Peter, go.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about breast cancer and actually BRCA2 positive indication. I've got a real strong family history of breast cancer, and everybody in the family except one fortunate sibling has a positive outcome. And so I'm getting annual mammograms, and knock wood, everything's fine so far. But my real concern is, I've known this for about, 3.5-4 years, and I've got a 27 and a 25-year-old daughter, two daughters. And they were discouraged from getting testing because it would have created, they were advised that it would have created a pre-existing qualification and may affect their insurance coverage. And I'm wondering, what's your sense about when they should get on the ball with this?
So, you know, that's an interesting question. The first thing I would tell you specifically is that the best person to answer this would be a genetic counselor. So okay. There are people whose entire jobs are to answer questions like this. I'm biased. I treat cancer all day long. So when I hear people say, you know, this is going to mess with the insurance or possibly create a pre-existing condition, I say, okay, but someone's at a huge risk for developing a malignancy, then you worry about that more.
I was very surprised with that advice, but it seemed to be, and I guess not uniform, but of course,
Peter, Obamacare has had something to say about pre-existing conditions.
I'm sorry, what care?
Obamacare.
Affordable health care. I wondered about whether or not that has changed this this environment a little bit. But like I said, I've got two sisters, both had radical mastectomies prophylactically, and so it's a real concern.
I would strongly recommend that you have them see a genetic counselor and possibly pursue mutation analysis testing.
Peter, I'm going to let you go. Everybody's behind you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Okay, let's go to Elaine in Amherst. We love Amherst. Have I ever told you that, Elaine?
What's that?
We love Amherst. Have I ever told you that?
No.
Okay,
I never talked to you, but I listen to you a lot.
I say it on the radio a lot. Go ahead.
Okay. I had a question. Is radiation you have throughout your lifetime cumulative?
The answer is yes, it is. It is cumulative.
Is there a maximum amount that we know causes cancer?
It's a probabilistic thing. Every time you get a little bit of radiation, it slightly increases the odds. But it's still a very, very, very rare thing to happen.
Yeah. I'm with you, Elaine. I worry about that also. And I've had too many chest x-rays in my life and too many other things, your CAT scans.
The future of diagnostic imaging is to actually measure this per patient.
Can they do it now? I mean, in other words, could they go in? Elaine's question is excellent. Can they go in and say, here's a diagnostic machine that will tell us how much radiation you've had in your life?
No, but the technologies do exist such that if you get a CAT scan, there can be a printout that says this is how much radiation you just received.
And if
that goes into a central database, then it can.
Elaine, I don't know about you, but too late for me.
Well, I've had a lot of x-rays in my lifetime.
Thanks for calling, Elaine.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Okay, Howard, you're on.
Oh, hi. I have a couple of questions, and one may sound like a challenging question, but my wife goes for, you ever heard of thermography to check for breast cancer, breast tumors?
I have not.
Me neither.
Okay, I think it's something you can look into, because for a woman to go in front of a machine and pump radiation into her breast, a perfectly sensitive, normal breast, over and over again, year after year, basically to pay for the machine.
No, Howard, your premise is incorrect. Basically
it's not incorrect.
Yeah, it is incorrect, Howard. It is incorrect. I mean, obviously, we have a doctor here who cures cancers and has a...
Oh, really,
Howard, yes.
I know many people who have been cured of cancer with no radiation and no chemotherapy.
Howard, thank you for the call. Let's go to Amolia in Schenectady. Amolia, you're on.
Hi. I have a question regarding monitoring lung cancer. I'm a 27-year-old woman. I'm healthy. I've never smoked. But I work in some extremely high pollution environments like Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, Kathmandu, Nepal, Delhi, India. And so I am exposed to extremely high, to the point of being dangerous, levels of environmental pollution. And I'm wondering how much of a concern that is. Is there anything that I should be doing in regards to either preventative or monitoring cancer? And I should note, I do have a history of cancer in my family, although not lung.
So, you know, that's a very difficult question to answer. unless someone had a very good handle on the exact pollutants that you're exposed to, but my answer would be...
It's primarily extremely high levels of coal.
Okay. I don't think anything specific or special would be done for someone in your case. Mm-hmm. If you're seeing your primary physician regularly and then get age-appropriate screening, I don't think that your exposure to these pollutants is likely to significantly increase your risk of a malignancy. I think people who get cancers related to, you know, environmental toxins are people that consume them over and over for a very long period of time. And, you know, there are a lot of different toxins out there, but having simply lived in places where there's a lot of pollution, I don't think anything different or special would need to be done in your situation.
But it is interesting. Amelia's question is very good in that you know, you read stories every day about people who have to wear masks in Peking, or people who are walking around in France having to drive only every other day because things are so tough. And one wonders, I'm sure it's been done epidemiologically, to say, well, okay, in some cases there's more incidence of cancer than in other places. I'm sure you're right.
Yeah, it was those news articles that inspired this question.
Yeah, I'll bet they were. I'll bet they were, Amelia. Hey, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Steve in Raleigh, North Carolina. Steve.
Hello there, Alan.
Hey.
I was wondering if a doctor would comment on age-related PSAs.
So I'm not sure I understand the question.
So if somebody has a high PSA, could it be – I'm just trying to fill in the blanks here. Could it be related to AIDS?
Exactly.
I am not aware of AIDS having any effect on the PSA one way or the other.
Well, however, as doctor has said, there is a major debate as to whether the PSA does what it's supposed to do. In other words, whether it really is the final indicator of whether a man has cancer. I mean, I know my urologist has told me stories about having done a digital on a guy who has basically a zero PSA and still found cancer.
Yeah. PSA is not a perfect tool. Unfortunately, it's the only tool we have. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand what your goals are before you order a PSA.
Well, you also have digital. You only say the only
That's
tool.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Steve, we're sorry we can't help you more. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, though.
Yeah. Bye. Let's go to Maureen in Glens Falls. Maureen, you're on.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about radiation that I received as a teenager. I had a perioral dermatitis, and a dermatologist sent me to have radiation treatment. Well, she did it in his office once a week for several months.
How old are you?
And I am now 67.
Okay, because we want to just get an idea, because as we said before, as doctor has said, in the old days, it was used a lot more prolifically than it is now.
Well, yeah.
Sometimes for acne.
The thing was that when I was 24, I was diagnosed with breast cancer and had a modified radical mastectomy. I'm wondering, first of all, do you think there could have been any connection to that? I have had genetic testing, and we do not have the BRCA1 and 2 genes in our family, although there is breast cancer in my family. The second thing is that since I was radiated on my face, and I always have a icky throat, you know, I'm wondering if that's a result of that radiation and if I have a risk of thyroid cancer.
So, excellent questions. It's certainly getting breast cancer at 24 is an unusual thing, but unless you were exposed to radiation that was delivered to your breast tissue, I don't think it had anything to do with that radiation exposure. We do see an increased risk of breast cancers in young women who were treated with radiation for Hodgkin's disease, where the breast tissue was necessarily irradiated. But superficial radiation for a skin issue on your face, I don't think that was related. Of course, it's impossible to know for sure. Getting radiation as a young girl to the face would increase your risk many years later of getting certain skin cancers. And if it was delivered close to your thyroid, then that would be a concern as well. Although, you know, if you've made it this long without anything, I think you're doing pretty well.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Let's go to Helen in Albany. 1-800-348-2551. Helen in Albany, go.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had breast cancer in 2001. I had a mastectomy. And then about 3.5 years ago, I had a local recurrence at the surgery site. So I'm being followed for that, and I'm on letrozole, and I up until this year I was having PET scans every 6 months, and I was just switched over to once a year, and I was just wondering what the radiation risk is with the PET scans.
A PET scan goes to where? Is that a brain?
PET scan is the entire body.
Okay, great.
So yeah, right.
You're injected with something that is radioactive, and it concentrates in areas that are using a lot of sugar, like a tumor. So in your case, the amount of radiation you're getting from the PET scan is really inconsequential. Your risk of us missing a cancer returning is much higher than your risk of the PET scan radiation causing a new cancer.
Even with the PET scan, missing it?
Even with the PET scan, I think the likelihood that that PET scan is going to cause a cancer is much, much less than your doctor's missing it coming back.
Helen, I'm trying to finish it all up. Thank you very much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, what's the difference between a sarcoma and a cancer? Julia wants to know.
A sarcoma is a type of cancer. A sarcoma is a type of cancer that arises in soft tissue. Bone, muscle, or fat.
Okay, very good. Let's go to Dave in Walk Hill. Dave, we're trying to finish it up now very quickly. What do you got?
I was asking about possible side effects or after effects of radiation on the body, nerve damage, and any doctors that might be able to zero in to help the effects.
So every organ in the body has a different tolerance for radiation, and part of my job is making sure that we don't over-radiate specific organs or structures. If you're below the tolerance, then it's unlikely for radiation to affect nerves.
And how do you know?
It's based on studies from people that have come before, based on studies from the laboratory, clones of tumors. It's mouse models, all sorts of basic science as well as clinical research to get a sense of how likely is radiation to harm someone. If you get above a certain threshold dose of radiation, then you put someone at risk for damaging the nerves or even possibly damaging the central nervous system if that's the area that got over-radiated. So it has to do with the dose of radiation that's delivered. If radiation causes damage to nerves, there's usually not a whole lot that can be done about it. If it's causing symptoms like pain, there are medications that might be helpful. But if it's causing weakness or something else like that, then there's unfortunately not a whole lot that can usually be done.
Dave, thank you very much.
Thanks
for the call. Okay. Well, we are just about out of time. My apologies to no one because nobody was left on the line. Get that? I want to thank Dr. Christopher Dolinsky of Northeast Radiation Oncology for being with us today. If you want to get in touch with them again, Northeast Radiation Oncology. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprosyn Pain Relief Creams that are natural biomedicine formulas bridging the gap between conventional medical care and natural medicine. Toprosyn.com. Thanks to our excellent engineer, Zach Malloy. Nothing flusters him. He's always on the job, and he's always got his hat on. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell, Esquire, for answering the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall, and I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop. On tomorrow's program, an open forum about something. Stay tuned now for a news update.